Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to Motive and Method. I'm Tim Watson Munro.
And I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett.
Well, Xanth, talk about drugs in the community. I'm sure you've been following the latest with the AFL in Victoria and the double standards when it comes to censure and punishment. For our listeners, on Tuesday, there were explosive allegations aired in Parliament by Federal MP Andrew Wilkie, who claimed that the AFL was conducting off-the-books covert drug tests to ensure players were clean on game day. We'll talk about this in more detail, but I just want to carry on about the allegations. The claim is allegedly supported by a signed statement the MP says he received from the former Melbourne Demons doctor, Zeeshan Aryan. The doctor allegedly claims that if a player confessed to using illicit substances, the player's sample would be sent to a private lab, Dorovich Pathology, in Heidelberg, Victoria, for a secret testing. If it was positive, players were allegedly told to fake an injury so they wouldn't be tested on game day, and therefore they would avoid a significant period on the bench. The MP claimed that not only did the AFL know, but this practice was in fact endorsed. This has sent shockwaves through the AFL and generally the community. On Wednesday, the AFL failed to flatly deny the allegations in a media release, saying, and I quote, "The AFL observes that AFL players are not immune to the societal issues faced by young people with respect to illicit substances, and also acknowledges that illicit drug use problems commonly co-occur with other mental health issues." They go on, "While the AFL's medical model involves a multidisciplinary healthcare management plan, the monitoring of players is highly confidential. A doctor or healthcare professional generally cannot disclose the nature of the clinical intervention or condition to others unless the player willingly consents." You don't get that kind of freedom when you're picked up on the street with a bag of coke. Tell you. "We understand that the illicit drugs policy can be improved, and we are working with the AFLPA and players to improve the policy and the system to ensure we are better able to change the behaviours of players. But we're unapologetic." I'll say that again. "We are unapologetic about club and AFL doctors taking the correct steps to ensure that any player who they believe has an illicit substance in their system does not take part in an AFL match, and that doctor-patient confidentiality is upheld and respected." And finally, to finish the quote, "The AFL will always be required to make decisions which seek to balance competing rights and interests. The medical interests and welfare of players is a priority for the AFL, given everything we know about the risks facing young people generally, and those who play our game in particular." I mean, what the actual, what do you think?
It's quite an extraordinary statement, isn't it? And I think they were probably caught a little bit off guard by Wilkes' comments in Parliament, which I'll detail in a moment. But this was certainly, you know, a huge statement by the AFL. And to say that they understand, you know, the issues around this faced by young people, and especially the young people who are taking drugs and how that commonly occurs with mental health conditions, yet not saying that this is not a practice that they've been conducting. I was actually quite flabbergasted that such a huge organization would be allegedly complicit in something of this nature. And so I was frankly shocked.
We'll discuss it in more detail, but it has all sorts of implications for fairness in sport, people backing their teams, role modelling for younger kids.
Huge.
And people who place a bet on a winning team. You know, if it's all doctored before the game, it's hardly a level playing field, is it?
It isn't. And there's obviously all of that, those issues. And especially, I think, I was struck by the role modelling. You know, lots of young people look up to these stars, these AFL athletes, as somebody they want to aspire to be. So knowing that drugs are potentially endemic part of that culture, that not only is it not condemned, but actually it's enabled by, you know, the people who are there to manage it, I think is really damaging. And I think it sends all the wrong messages to those people who aspire to join that particular industry.
What did Wilkie say in Parliament?
Well, it was quite a long statement. So again, I'll quote this because it was like this, I think, came as a bit of a bombshell to pretty much everyone, the AFL and everyone in Parliament, and I'm sure a lot of sports fans. So this is what he said in Parliament on Wednesday night. I rise to bring the House's attention to deeply troubling allegations of egregious misconduct within the AFL provided by former Melbourne Football Club president Glenn Bartlett, former Melbourne Football Club Dr. Zishan Arane, and Sean Smith, father of Melbourne player and now alleged drug trafficker, Joel Smith. The allegations include the prevalence of drug abuse and other prohibited behaviour across the AFL, off-the-books drug testing of players at Dorovich Pathology in Heidelberg, facilitated, you note, by the former chief medical officer of the AFL, Peter Harcourt, the resting of players testing positive in these secret tests, ostensibly on account of injury, willful inaction by AFL chairman Richard Goyder and former CEO Jill McLaughlin. He goes on.
They're all allegations, aren't they?
They are absolutely allegations, but you have to note that Dorovich Pathology has been named. These are very specific allegations that have been tabled. So, you know, it's quite rare to see such a level of detail. I think this has certainly got to be taken seriously. But yes, absolutely, I would note these are allegations only at this time. He went on to say, again, quote, the allegations are credible, detailed, and provide in signed statements which have been given to me, which clearly identify the sources of the information. The allegations are deeply troubling. Such appalling behaviour endangers the life, safety, and future of players and officials, subverts the official drug testing conducted by Sports Integrity Australia on behalf of the World Anti-Doping Authority, and is a fraud on the governments that provide millions of dollars in support of the AFL directly and indirectly through tax breaks, grants, and beneficial capital works, conditional on the AFL being a signatory to and complying with WADA code.
Might just clarify for the listeners, the AFLPA is the Australian Football League Players Association.
Correct, yeah. Now, again, Wilkie goes on to say, here is what happened, as has been described to me by Dr. Arane. The AFL wants the player to play at all costs, and so the cover-up begins. If there was no illegal drugs in the player's system, they're free to play. And if there are drugs in their system, the player is often asked to fake an injury. They were advised to lie about a condition which results in off-the-book tests, are kept secret, and never shared with the Sports Integrity Australia or the WADA. But, as Dr. Arane explains, this isn't just a Melbourne problem. It's an AFL problem, with multiple players coming to Melbourne from other teams with pre-existing cocaine dependencies, more than suggesting that drug testing workarounds are commonplace elsewhere in the AFL. Wilkie concludes by saying the documents in my possession also indicate a shocking unwillingness of senior AFL executives to address drug abuse by players and executives, particularly in relation to cocaine use. Now, I think that is really out there in terms of naming and shaming, isn't it? And again, we say these are allegations, but this is huge. These are huge claims made against not only the Melbourne teams, but also suggesting a much broader systemic issue across the AFL. That is cultural. Surely you can class that as cultural.
I think it is. And some people are angry. Speaking about the allegation on Nine's Today on Wednesday morning, former Australian Rules footballer and coach Mick Malthouse said as follows, "It's quite damning. It's such a surprise. I can't believe how angry I've got just hearing the news." He goes on, "We have an obligation for the players' health to start off. We have an obligation to the game, want a fair, honest game. We want players who run down the race to play good football without compromise. Amen, Milk."
Totally agree. And, you know, I do think these young men potentially are at risk of developing dependencies, given, you know, they're earning a lot of money. Obviously, they're in the kind of right age bracket to be influenced into those kind of activities. But the health impacts it will have on them, and to have the suggestion that a body which is meant to protect them is doing nothing to assist them to stop taking a drug as serious as cocaine, I think is really, I'm really hoping that this is seriously addressed. But what do you think possibly some of the bigger issues are here? Because we're obviously talking about the AFL, and that's bad enough that these players are not being cared for and all of that side of it, their own physical and mental health. But what are some of these broader issues? Because I think we're really looking at, you know, almost two classes of society here, because not everyone would get a free run like this if they, you know, were taking hard drugs, that it would actually be covered up for them.
Well, I agree. I think, you know, their response to all this is, you know, you give a bloke a chance, you in fact give him three chances, and you hope that he won't be caught fourth time.
But, oh, you mean the three strikes and they're out type thing?
Yeah, I've always said I think it's nonsense. And look, I understand the right to medical privacy. I understand all of that. But these people are elite athletes. They're paid huge sums of money. The clubs make huge amounts of money out of their playing. People bet lots of money on the game and so on. So I think, you know, to have this two standards, one for the community, one for the AFL, is just, it's plain out hypocritical. And to have people in positions of authority, well-regarded people in the community saying, nothing to see here, what's all the fuss about? Tell that to any one of the kids that I assess in any given week who are picked up with a bag or two of cocaine on the street. You know, in Sydney, where I practice quite a lot, it's common knowledge that if you walk down Crown Street and you score cocaine, within 10 minutes, you'll be picked up by the police who are doing undercover stuff. They don't get three strikes. They don't get people saying, oh, well, look, just go and do a urine screen and we'll cover it up and we won't comply with the law and order of the country. And eventually, these kids are put before magistrates who give them a right royal dressing down. Quite often, they're students, even if they're not. They worry about their future careers, because if they have a conviction for drug possession and use, it can be have diabolical implications for them. So there's double standards here. And I just wonder, arising from that, the type of message that this sends to kids in the community.
And what about the thing, yeah, exactly. And what about the AFL's response, given, you know, if that's the message they're sending out and they're claiming that this is all okay because allegedly, you know, these are private medical tests. So they're not, in fact, not only not obligated to report them, but obligated to keep them confidential. What are your thoughts around that?
I think it's all too cute. It's proactive scheme to protect players from getting caught, which will affect their capacity in the game. And sure, if they test positive, they shouldn't be playing, but it kind of, I think it diminishes the seriousness of what's going on here.
Do you think it actually almost encourages these players to take drugs such as cocaine? Because they know that a mechanism is allegedly in place by which they will avoid any level of punishment. So if you come into it, is there some sort of, you know, peer pressure almost potentially for some to actually engage in a very risky behavior, because that's normalized by the processes that are allegedly in place?
The statistic which hasn't been revealed, which I'd be interested in, is how many of these people are repeat offenders? How many of them have given a positive sample, you know, sit on the crying bench, fake an ACL injury, whatever it may be, COVID, and they're back in 3 weeks' time repeating the behaviour. It's really quite astounding, I think.
So some of the broader issues then, obviously we're looking at what message this sends to potentially vulnerable people in the community. You know, for example, young AFL aspirants. I mean, you were a young sporting guy not very long ago. You know, you could have been one of those people, who would have aspired to actually be like these guys. So do you think it could have an influence on them?
Yeah, people find it hard to believe I was a sprint champion. You know,
I don't find that hard to believe at all.
I've still got the attitude, but not the physique. Of course, when you're young and you're involved in sport, you want to go as far as you can with the sport. You're an elite athlete too, as I recall. You know what we're talking about. You know, you're driven, you're motivated. And part of that is the role models that you have. And, you know, it was so long ago with me, but I used to read books about Jesse Owens and his competition in the Berlin Olympics. You know, he was a multi-gold winner. Hitler refused to shake his hand and all the rest of it. Boy, could that guy run. Now, he was a lot younger than me, obviously, but it's the point is you do read up about these people and more close to home. You know, amongst my many children, I have two sons. One of them was a very talented footy player at school, and he really continues to look up to, he's an adult now, but he continues to look up to these players. I just wonder how this type of attitude impacts upon their perception of the game, the fairness of around the game, and the individuals that are exposed. But the thing is, we never know who they are.
They're because it's all very secret.
They're not remaining ashamed. And I'll just finish on that. Without that, where's the motivation to change your behaviour?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would be keen on naming and shaming individual players, because I really think the bigger issue for me here is if these allegations are true, then this is something that is being enabled systemically. And I think that is a huge problem, because we know that in Australia, this is a massive destination country for drugs like cocaine. We're paying, you know, several times more what they're paying in other countries for the drug. So it's transited, much of it's through Asia, and it's coming into Australia, and it's a huge nationwide scourge. And so to hear that the AFL are knowingly enabling people to get hooked on or engaged with such a strong drug, I think is really scary. And we know that it's rife in Australia. We're the highest users of cocaine per person in the world. In the world.
And look, they pay a lot for it. And I know a fair bit about this. I mean, it's no secret. It was well publicised. You know, 25 years ago, I used cocaine. And I was named and shamed. And it certainly, it narrowed my focus in terms of getting on top of the problem, which I'm happy to say I did.
So but, is that what you would advocate here, almost to help the people who are repeat offenders? As not just, I'm not just thinking AFL players now, but perhaps this is happening in other sports. I don't know, but you can see where there may be potential for that, given the amount of money that's involved when these players are benched. Is that something that helped you then? Is that something you would advocate? Or do you see that as potentially damaging for these players?
Well, you know, I think it's both. I don't want to get too much into what went on with me, but certainly the public expose of my behaviour back then as a high-profile psychologist, it didn't give me any wiggle room. And what the AFL is providing these people is wiggle room. And, you know, give them a chance, give them two chances. But really, it flies in the face of the general attitude in the community. That's what I'm saying.
Mm.
And marry the two. The perception is that there's one of entitlement and privilege that is not afforded to other people. And I think that's not necessarily a helpful thing. You know, putting it all over the newspapers, leaving me to one side, it's so long ago, will not help somebody. I think the correct approach is to get somebody into treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a highly addictive drug. And as you correctly point out, Santh, Australians are addicts. We're the highest users of cocaine and probably other drugs in the world. And we pay the most for cocaine. I mean, the prices of cocaine that I hear from clients I see are just astronomical compared to, you know, better quality gear that people get overseas, 10 times the price in some places. So, and they're prepared to wear it. And, you know, I speak to police about this. I look at analysis reports of the actual purity of the drug that a person's picked up with. Often it has been so diluted, they're essentially paying for talcum powder. And so it's a really weird phenomenon out there. And it's kind of strange how Australians are so much in love with this drug. And it's not just a class thing. You know, there's a lot of analysis of, it's not a job I want, but there are professionals in hazmat suits that measure and assess effluent in various cities. And what they will say, what they do say, is that there's a lot of cocaine used in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. There's a lot of cocaine in Toorak and South Yarra and probably other sort of privileged suburbs throughout Australia. It's become the sort of de rigueur in some situations. It's become totally acceptable in some situations. This kind of news is going to do nothing to unpack that sort of nonsense. It is a highly dangerous, highly addictive drug that ruins lives. I don't know anyone with a severe coke habit that comes out the other side, undamaged by the process.
And I think what people don't realise as well is that any kind of illicit drug use is actually fueling and funding organised crime. The same people who are trafficking drugs into Australia are also trafficking guns, they're trafficking people. They're involved in the organised crime networks that are causing problems on our streets, that are leading to shootings, all the things that we think are appalling. And yet drug use is fueling that, is literally funding that. And I think people would be surprised as well. I was looking at some data around this as to who is actually using these drugs. And you alluded to it. You know, we're talking about some very affluent neighborhoods are showing this, the highest rates of drug use, looking at that chemical analysis of the sewage. And apparently the use is highest among employed Australians, which makes sense given how expensive these drugs are. And there's suggestions that I was reading that it's rife, not just in some sporting codes, but also there have been periods when it's been rife in the construction industry, hospitality, mining, but none of those big businesses have attempted to cover it up. You know, they're not doing drug testing and saying, okay, just sleep it off and come back tomorrow. They understand the dangers of having people who are drug affected or substance users, be that drugs, be that alcohol, on these sites. You know, we're talking like mines, et cetera, very dangerous places. And they've taken this really seriously. And yet, if we're seeing in sporting codes that it's potentially being, if not encouraged, certainly not, you know, discouraged, if it's being hidden, then that shows a very different mindset into how this is being managed.
It does. And look, the flip to this is maybe people should think about decriminalizing these drugs. But I think it should be one size fits all, one shoe fits everyone. And you can't have one set of rules for a certain subset in the community and a different set of rules for everybody else. The dangerousness of these drugs has been well documented, and it's not just in industry. You look at what goes on in festivals and so on.
Exactly. And then they bring out the drug dogs, right? They try and prevent drugs at festivals. It's clamped down on, people arrested, people are charged. You know, we're talking not just music festivals where we've seen a lot of that, but people on public transport, other public spaces. So clearly the police are sending a message, drugs are bad, which I would agree with, drugs are bad. And yet we've seen people who are role models, who are, you know, kids look up to, who are engaged in these alleged activities. And so, but it's not being policed by potentially the AFL.
Well, here's another one. The AFL players, if they, you know, they say abuse drugs, they'll get tested. And yet there's such strong sort of opposition, stonewalling to the idea that you have properly constituted drug testing facilities at the gates of these festivals. So people can produce their drugs, have them tested. Guess what?
I'm in favour of drug testing at festivals.
I am too.
It will save lives. It will absolutely save lives. You're not going to stop people taking it at festivals. So let them test the drugs and make sure that they're not going to take something that's going to kill them. It makes sense to me. I don't know why we would fight that.
And so clearly what we're talking about and observing is a lot of confusion out there about different messages, different rules, different attitudes. I mean, in the ACT now, they've decriminalised possession of small amounts of all sorts of drugs. Let's wait and see what happens. But
be interesting.
I think what I'm perseverating about is just the double standards and the idea that the AFL has that this is all okay without looking at the broader implications of how this attitude and these behaviours impact on the community, the vulnerable in the community, and the young kids who really look up to these people. And I was quite staggered when I read that response, frankly.
And what was the government response? Because we were talking about this earlier, and I think you mentioned that there's been some discussions at a higher level as well.
Well, even at Wilkie's level, which is a higher level, he sought leave to table the documents that you've summarised, and I've summarised, in Parliament. Why not? You've exploded the grenade. Why not put the evidence on the table? And he wasn't permitted to do so. And again, I'm flabbergasted by that. If you have a federal government that is serious about addressing what is a growing and endemic problem in the community, why wouldn't you table the documents and let people have a look at them?
Yeah, I think we need to see them. We need to see them as a community. We need to see those documents. And again, in preparation with this, I was reading around this some articles that I came across, so journal pieces, and I read one that was published in 2022 by McKenty et al, entitled Increasing Cocaine Use Amongst Employed Australians, Who is Most at Risk? Because I was interested, like, who is going to be doing these drugs and why, in essence, you know, why do people get engaged? And what the paper said was that there have been large increases occurring between 2016 to 2019, predominantly amongst employed Australians, and that increased by 63%. And it would be interesting to see what happened in 2019, actually, because remember, that was as we were leading into COVID. Yeah. So I think the patterns of drug use, we certainly saw some of that in the media about these kind of drug deliveries, you know, that became quite popular in some of our cities, that, you know, people couldn't go out and get their drugs. So we had, you know, delivery services kind of springing up. So it'd be interesting to see what the patterns were that changed since 2019. But this paper was focused on 2016 to 19. And it looked at predictions of use too, and said that there were a number of patterns. Age was a predictive factor in terms of younger people. So people age 18 to 24 years. Marital status was influential, the state they lived in, how remote they were, their smoking status, their use of alcohol, and their approval level generally of cocaine.
Which is an important one, getting back to the central thesis of this discussion. What you're hearing from the AFL is that there's a kind of nod as good as a wink approval of what's going on.
Allegedly. Let's give
it that. Yeah, allegedly going on. There's certainly no suggestion of disapproval in what has allegedly been said to date. And so it's very true. Drug users tend to congregate with other drug users. It can normalise their behaviour, and they can lose sight of the broader implications in the community.
This paper spoke to some of that. And it interestingly also said that the income and high psychological distress were relevant, and I think that's important, because are we seeing potentially these athletes under a lot of psychological stress, again, with other industries too? And is that something that could actually be managed to help reduce the use of these types of drugs in sporting codes? And in
point on that, sorry to interrupt you, but years ago, I was a lecturer at Detective Training School in Victoria. And I was retained by Vic Pohl to do that. And I would give a lecture on a Friday afternoon for each course. It happened to be a lecture on sexual deviance, because I knew that I'd have their undivided attention. But we would knock off early. And this was held at the old Russell Street Police Complex. And I'd say, well, why don't we adjourn next door to the police club and we'll continue the discussions there, which they were all very happy to do. The thing that struck me at the police club was on a Friday afternoon, the amount of booze consumed by these people off duty, I stress to add. And it was really them just, I guess, decompressing, debriefing, drinking copious amounts of alcohol because of work-related pressures. And, mm-hmm. you know, very sympathetic to that. I think the police have a lot of pressures to contend with. So too AFL players, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Competition.
And even with people who are not at that level, this paper talks about some individual level characteristics which influence workers' cocaine use. And it specifically spoke about workplace cultural norms and substance use climates that may facilitate increased cocaine use, and how the workplace is a powerful setting for cocaine prevention and intervention. And I would be shocked to think that any industry would not want to intervene and diminish the use rather than facilitating. And it also talked about strategies, including targeting social norms in that particular environment, shifting positive drug use workplace cultures, providing health and safety training, focusing on the risk to staff and co-workers, whilst also examining the different demographic subgroups' motivations for use. So perhaps this is actually a bit of a reckoning if these allegations are found to be true. And actually, we know how some of these things can be reduced and, you know, hopefully managed to the benefit of the players and the game as a whole. And so I'm hoping now that there may actually be some changes in that culture if these allegations are in fact correct.
I don't think you can overstate the power of peer group dynamics. So it can be a force for good in terms of reducing substance use, or it can be a force for exacerbating the problem. So if people in your team are using, that's a bit of a boys club mentality. It's a bit naughty. It's a bit of an adventure for them. It's a hard wall to break through. And it gets back to, you know, we've discussed this many times, referable to other criminological, sociological, psychological issues in the community. It gets down to better education and, you know, keeping the genie in the bottle before it escapes. I fear now in Australia, the genie has well and truly escaped. Cocaine use has been normalised. It's used at dinner parties. It's used everywhere. And it's now in sport. And I'd be amazed if it was just confined to AFL.
Yeah, me too.
RL. In fact, you know, no names, no pack drill, but I've assessed a number of NRL players over the years. And generally after they've left the game, they become very depressed. They have Lyme-like deprivation syndrome, as mm-hmm. I describe it. And attendant to that, they can drift into a pattern of either heavy drinking or coke use or both, because coke will enable protracted drinking sessions. So it's about education, recognising the problem. And I get back to this. You know, I mentioned it before. I'd like to know how many repeat offenders there are and what actually happens between times, whether there's actually, look, you've tested positive, you're going to miss the game, nobody's going to know, but do they then have some sort of sotto voce, subtle, never declared intervention introduced to assist them with a problem? That doesn't come out in what we've read so far, but I would respectfully suggest it should occur, that if somebody is tested positive and they're given a chance, they should seize the moment and get help. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, just testing somebody and saying sit on the bench this week, that's not a solution. And it's going to be really interesting what happens going forward, because I think shockwaves have genuinely been sent through the AFL. And I wouldn't be surprised if it transpires, as you mentioned, that this is not just in that particular code and that other issues now come forward. So maybe this is a time when we're going to see change. I think we certainly need to if the allegations are true. So it's going to be very interesting watching this going forward, because I just don't think that this is something the community will accept.
I think it's very significant when a bloke of Mick Malthouse's stature, you know, a living legend in Victoria for sums, and an amazing coach, a real force to be reckoned with in the game in years gone by. When someone of his stature gets up and makes the comments he does about being angry and so on, people should listen. I mean, it shouldn't just be Mick out there. Everybody should be saying, well, hold the phone. This is unacceptable and we need to look at this problem more closely and deal with it.
Yeah, I think there are a number of levels to help the players who are suffering from substance abuse issues and to prevent this cycle from continuing. We don't want more young people going in and falling into these same traps. So, Yeah, I genuinely hope something is done about this now. So we shall see going forward.
The space.
Exactly. And
go the Swans.
Okay, I'll let you. You choose your team. I'm not an AFL person, so we'll go with whichever team you like.
Well, you know, I go for them all. I just thought I'd throw that in. They're going very well at the moment.
Oh, so whoever's winning, I see your style.
Not really. Well, I'm Tim Watson Munro. Thank you for listening.
And I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Motive and Method, and we look forward to sharing more insights with you again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.